To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Tune into KABU Wednesday, July 24th from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. for the 21st Annual Homelessness Marathon. Broadcasting from a different city each year and airing on non-commercial radio stations coast to coast, this annual marathon features live reports, interviews with advocates and experts, and calls from listeners all over the country. This year's programming includes the voices of youth, students, and LGBTQ people, panels on fighting evictions, transitioning people back into housing, and ending homelessness now. That's the Homelessness Marathon, Wednesday, July 24th, from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Baby, you understand me now.
Hi, greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. Tonight, we're here with two very, I'd say, important people as far as the movement to free U.S.-held political prisoners and people who are really holding up that work, including someone who's also a former political prisoner. And we're here with Masai Ehehosi. How you doing, Masai?
I'm good, Adam.
All right. Good to hear your voice. And also with us is Paulette Doté. Paulette, you here?
I'm here. Nice to hear you, Adam.
Hi.
And Masai.
And Paulette also works with the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. So starting off, Masai, can you maybe just tell us a little bit about yourself being a former political prisoner and why this issue, among other things, is so important in deconstructing the prison industrial complex?
Okay, well, again, greetings to all and assalamu alaikum. Okay, as you said, my name is Masai Ehehosi. I was, for about 14 years, I was inside as a member of the Black Liberation Army and a citizen of the Republic of New Africa. I was part of a unit that had an incident down in Virginia, along with a sister named Safia Bakari, who went on to be one of the co-founders of the Jericho Movement for Amnesty for Political Prisoners and POW. Amnesty for Political Prisoners and POWs, and a brother named Kombozi Armstead, who was actually murdered then. That was in 1975. After I got out, you know, I continued to be involved with work related to the movement, particularly around the independence of the New African Nation. At some point, I became involved with Jericho. After I came back to New York, I had been in Chicago for a while. I was up in New York, and at that time, I became involved with Jericho, the Jericho Amnesty Movement. With the whole thing is like, and I think other people have said it several times. It's like, you know, it's hard to talk about, you know, a movement for independence or a movement for social justice and not talk about political prisoners and POWs, because the reality is if you're doing anything against the empire, then they're coming after you. And part of what I want to say, it can get quite long, because like I keep thinking about the connections. For me, it connects. I know, like, this year, it's the 50th anniversary of the Benson Ramos Brigade, you know, on the trips to Cuba. And I'm thinking about how much time has went by where people don't remember, like, the tremendous amount of support that the Cuban people gave, and a large part of the reasons why they've been isolated and vilified so much by the U.S. government, not just because of the example they represented to other people who were oppressed, but because of the principal support they provided for our political prisoners and POWs. I think about back in the time when some of us were naive enough, you know, we knew the U.S. was vicious, but we didn't just really know just how vicious it was. I mean, like, not only does it violate international law and norms within its own boundaries, but it does it throughout the world, and it does it so much now where, like, people take it for granted. We tend to accept that the U.S. can do what they want to do. And I think about that in regards to Cuba, because when a lot of us got involved in the struggle, particularly from the Black Liberation Movement, it was like the thought, like Malcolm had said, like, you know, if we take it to the international arena, then, you know, people could put pressure on the U.S. They might be embarrassed a little way, but they actually far from embarrassed. And not only that, it's like I said, like the suffering that they put on the Cuban people. And I think about the fact that because we're talking for so much time, a lot of the people in Cuba may not even realize, well, they know they're going through a lot of suffering, but they may not even realize the cause of it. And that goes back to a lot of people here who may not realize just how messed up the situation is. And as long as we can hide away people who represent that resistance, a lot of people can, you know, can just act like it's not there.
And the two of you have both done some international, if I can use the word networking, going to different international human rights events and conferences abroad and talking about these cases and helping to amplify those voices. And so many of the names of these prisoners people might not even know about. And I know one of our goals was to talk about a few kind of immediate cases right now, because some people have passed away inside, some people have actually gotten out, and then we have so many people who are still inside that are also aging and having a lot of difficulties with personal health, and then of course the legal support. So moving into that, you wanted to talk a little bit about I think some of the former Panthers and Black Liberation Army political prisoners.
Okay, and maybe I'll just read some of the names. Well, among some of them is, of course, Imam Jamil Abdul El-Amin, who's formerly known as H.R.F. Brown. He has severe health issues. He's presently in Tucson, Arizona. And, well, he's been involved. Not only has he leadership within the Islamic community, but he was one of the leadership, one of the chairpersons at one time for the Student National Coordinating Committee. There's people like Mameen Kabar, who was actually a brother who's part of the same Islamic formation that I'm a part of. He's had severe health issues this year, and that actually after two very severe incidents earlier this year, the Bureau of Prisons, well, the institution went ahead and submitted a request for him to be released on compassionate release. Right now, that's at the regional administration level, and it's been there, I think, for about a month and a half or 2 months. So, you know, we're hoping that that's a favorable thing. Some other people like Sister Althea Siddiqui, who a lot of people aren't familiar with. She's a Muslim sister. She was captured by the U.S. under messed up circumstances, and they actually have her isolated down there in Florence, Colorado. Larry Hoover, Ed Poindexter, Kojo Bomani, Abdul Aziz, Kamal Siddiqui, and Kamal is like, you know, like a lot of these people I mentioned, they're some good people, some humble people. Kamal has been involved in the struggle for a long time, and basically one of the reasons why they wanted Kamal inside was because they wanted to use him as some kind, they thought he could be leveraged to get our sister Asada Secor back from Cuba. You know, he'd be able to get her back here some way. Russell Maroon Schultz, and of course Mumuy Abu Jamal. And almost all of these people I'm talking about, these people have been in here like, wow, you know, we're talking about 20 might be the least amount of time, 30, 40 years and things.
And Masai, don't forget there's Veranza Bowers and the Virgin Island 3. And the Virgin Island 3 just started their 49th year of incarceration.
Wow.
Right. Yeah, and in terms of time, I mean, because we can't forget. Right. I was reading some of the ones. These are the ones. And actually, I was reading them because, like, these are some of the ones we have down with severe health problems. But we have a whole lot more than this, really. I mean, like, this Sundiata Coley. Mm-hmm. I think, what, Sundiata is in his 80s or something like that.
Right, so, and he got a 15-year hit, meaning that the last time he went to the pro board, by the time he's 95, he'll be eligible to go before the parole board.
And he was one of our earliest prisoners that they threw out of state. He was in New Jersey, and they hooked him up under the interstate compact with the federal government. Actually, a lot of the people I just mentioned, actually, some of them is like, they're actually state prisoners, but they've been turned over to the custody of the feds, and that allows the feds to ship them anywhere they want, you know, under extreme conditions.
So there's a few examples, not many, not enough, of some people who have maybe fairly recently been released for various reasons. Going back to Clinton, there was a few people who were released from Weather Underground, and then recently with Obama was Chelsea Manning and also Oscar Lopez Rivera from the Puerto Rican independence movement. Are there other people we can talk about recently that have gotten out, like the MOVE folks? And any other folks who have gotten out?
Well, I got to meet, there was an anti-toxic prison conference here in Florida, and the Michael and Jeanette were here on the MOVE. And it was so wonderful, Michael and Debbie. And when, you know, you couldn't believe it after writing to them for 30 years to meet them in person. It just took your breath away. And all we could do was hug each other and say, oh, my God. And, you know, their commitment to bringing everybody else home is what makes them really... not just former political prisoners, but human beings, you know, people who have a respect for nature, for each other, and a commitment. But I wanted to mention something that Masai said. In 1975, when he was involved in that incident, was also the time that there was an incident on Pine Ridge. And in 1976, when I was a member of the Vincent Ramos Brigade, is when Bob Robidoux and Dino Butler were found not guilty of the incident. So those years of the 70s were so important to national liberation struggles and to people's struggles here. You know, when he mentioned Sister Sophia, she is like this star in the sky that all of us in Jericho and people throughout this country had a chance to meet her to understand what being a true, you know, revolutionary Muslim meant. And so all her work, and she worked tirelessly for years. She was also in prison, and when she got out, she became one of the founders of Jericho, along with Jaleel, and the name just slipped away.
So Jaleel Muntakeem.
Herman Ferguson.
Right.
Right, another founder.
Ferguson, right. So the three of them, you know, founded Jericho, and all those wonderful political prisoners that Masai talked about are members of the Jericho movement. You know, the Jericho movement was formed because they had been down so long that many of our comrades no longer had parents. You know, their families, they were older and had passed on, and defense committees were disappearing, and so Jericho took the responsibility of maintaining these wonderful people who had fought for the people. So it's it all ties together, the national liberation struggles, the Black Liberation Army, the American Indian movements, you know, the Chicano-Mexicano movement that were of that time. And these are who we're talking about, people who have done 30 to 50 years in prison. Rochelle McGee, I think it's 55 years he's been in prison. And, you know, people forget. They go about their business. But those of us that know these wonderful folks have a commitment that we can't stop doing this work until they all come home.
For folks just tuning in, you're listening to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. And we're here with Masai Ehehosi and Paulette Dotay, both long-term, dedicated community organizers, prison activists fighting specifically on behalf of U.S.-held political prisoners who were long-term U.S.-held political prisoners. Some of them also identify or can be identified as prisoners of war. And we're talking about the long sentences that all of these folks have endured. And correct me if I'm wrong for either one of you, but that the sentences sound even longer than some of the time that Nelson Mandela has done. And so many people know Nelson Mandela, might not know exactly what he was involved with, but very familiar with, you know, the general idea. And then there's the silence here in the U.S. So can you talk about getting back to some of the particular cases and how some people are doing, and how this work is so difficult in the case of really getting this word out and what that work entails?
Masai, you mind if I take a minute and talk about Leonard?
No, go ahead.
Well, I'm the national director of Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, and Leonard Peltier is one of the ones that we call a prisoner of war. He's a member of the Turtle Mountain Anishinaabe Nation and part of the Ogallala Sioux Nation. Leonard was involved in a defense of the Jumping Bull Ranch, which is in Ogallala, which is on Pine Ridge, South Dakota. Two FBI agents came onto the land. Gunfight ensued. The two agents died, as well as our wonderful comrade Joe Stuntz. Out of this, three adult men, Bob, Robidoux, Dino Butler, and Leonard Peltier, were tried. Bob and Dino separately found not guilty on the grounds of self-defense. When it came time for Leonard to be on trial, they judge shopped and found a judge in North Dakota who refused to allow his lawyers to put on the defense that Bob and Dino had. And he was convicted of aiding and abetting in the murder of two FBI agents and has just started his 44th year in prison. He'll be 75 in September. And when we applied for a transfer for him, he was told that he still was considered a high security risk and could not get a transfer out of the USP. Leonard has poor health. He's 75. He has old men problems. He has arthritis. And for them to try and use this as a way to keep him from being closer to his home, it just shows the vindictiveness of not only the FBI but the government that has followed this. And Leonard has done time with many, many of the people that Masai mentioned, because they are all federal prisoners, even if they're holding in the state. So Masai and I had talked earlier about families, and Leonard is in Coleman Prison, and it's on lockdown now. But his aunt, who is 72, had come out to visit him, And of course, during a lockdown, you can't have a visit. And Masai and I talked about not only are the prisoners held captive, but so are their families. And whether it's Mao Min, whose sister is disabled and tries to get up there to see him, or Leonard's family, or Kamal Siddiqui's daughter, there's all these roadblocks put in the way of them being able to have any kind of decent relationships with their families.
Mm-hmm.
Masai, you were going to mention a couple of the other ones.
Right, and it kind of, and it also it relates to like why part of the reason why some of the work is difficult. Okay, I think I mentioned Larry Hoover, he's in Florence, Colorado, and along with Larry Hoover though is Abdullah Malik Kaba. You know, a lot of people know as Jeff Ford. They're among some of the longest held in Florence, And some of the same things when Paulette was saying, like when institutions are on lockdown or for whatever reason that the institution give, they can stop people's visits. And a lot of times I'd be hesitant about saying certain things because, like, the institution will make it into a code name thing and they'll stop the visits and there's nothing you can do. Like, Jericho has been trying to get in communication with some people like Larry and Jeff Ford, like, sometimes it goes for years, and we have no way of knowing. Well, a lot of times we know our letters can't get in, and we don't even know whether they got it. And we've seen times when the families, you know, so a lot of these people, they haven't, family members have died, and they haven't had any contact with them. Sometimes they don't even know, you know, for a long time. So you got to figure that it has an impact on them. A lot of people, sometimes their spirits, some people's spirits is better than others, but you can't help but think that's got to have an impact on people when you're kept away from family and not even allowed to communicate. But I would think they've been over 20 years. Yeah.
You should explain when you mentioned Florence. Leonard is held at a U.S. penitentiary, which means it has walls and it has towers. That's the highest in the normal rating for the Bureau of Prisons. When he talked about Florence, that is a supermax where all the prisoners are locked in their cell 23 hours a day. Now, Leonard is at a USP, and he is in an elder unit. So when they're locked down like now, they're not held in their cells. They can at least get out and walk around in the TV room, because for older prisoners, people cannot be locked down for that length of time. I mean, look what happened to Mutulu. He was locked down, and all they had were peanut butter sandwiches and so much sodium, it caused him to have a stroke. And so, you know, they just, this viciousness of this. So Larry and that are held
Malik,
in Florence, worst of the worst.
Right, and it's so bad that actually several years ago, the European Union, prisoners, if they thought that prisoners were going to be sent to the United States to be put in Florence, they wouldn't let them come. Mm-hmm. That's just how bad Florence's reputation they got. And when we talk about how long certain work has went on, like in the past, courts have held like those type of units were, you know, what they call unconstitutional, you know, violated certain rights. And what states can do and the federal government would do is they would just rename them, rebrand them, and come back with them. In the case of Florence, I don't even know. I mean, there's challenges, but we're at a point now where, like, Florence, it doesn't seem like it's going anywhere. But that's just how long it's been, that the changes that we've seen, that fascism that people are talking about, mm-hmm. That's what we're seeing. Because, I mean, 20, 30 years ago, when Marion was open, Marion was challenged on certain grounds. Marion used to be the highest security level, and that's where revolutionaries went. And they had said at the time the purpose of Marion federal prison was to break the revolutionary spirit both within the prison system and in society at large. So Florence has just gotten worse. And So, yeah, and sometimes I think people really, anybody listening, they really need to do some research on it. And I'm going to, if we didn't say it already, people need to go on the Jericho website and they could find out people's contact information, find out some more about them cases. And I wanted to say this because I'm not sure how much time we got. Also, when you talked about some of the difficulties of the work, I think, like, sometimes what it is like people on the outside basically – if they didn't have any understanding about where movements were trying to go, it's like sometimes they people get to the point where they say, well, we'll just accept anything, and they start shouting like there's a victory. And that becomes kind of hard for some people inside to accept. I mean, everybody inside ain't supposed to be shouldering the whole blame, a whole load. And I ain't saying that people out here aren't shouldering a lot of a load. But a lot of times people just don't know just how serious it is, which is, again, when they look at, like, the condition and the treatment of those folks, it will show them. I know, like, because I'm also part of a critical resistance, and I would tell people they need to check out the website criticalresistance.org, because Adam, you started off even talking about the prison industrial complex. Mm-hmm. Critical resistance is, you know, a formation committed to abolishing the whole prison industrial complex. Not closing down prisons or just closing down prisons, but the whole complex. And I know we had this conversation within Critical. It was like, well, several years ago, where that sometimes people will struggle, and what they would be struggling for, though, is like to go back to a time before a certain period, as if that was a better period. Like, you know, like the struggle is all supposed to be, it's supposed to be about getting rid of Trump, going back to pre-Trump, like that was better for oppressed people. Prior to that, it might be, well, we got to go back to the days before September 11th. But for oppressed people who are struggling for, you know, independence and self-determination, that's not, they're not just trying to go back to, like, you know, those conditions again just because it's a different oppressor or they're oppressed in a different way. So that becomes part of the problem, because the conversation sometimes ain't held that deep. Mm-hmm. And again, though, relating it to political prisoners and POWs, we also know that a lot of people are afraid. And that's the purpose also. When you make examples of certain people inside, you let people know, you know, like, if you think that you're going to rebel, this is what we have for you, and this is where you're going. So a lot of people, you know, or some of the people who are still around who we know better, they're not going to speak for so much. Mm-hmm. It's like, because if I acknowledge oppression, then I might have to deal with it. But if I say it really ain't that way, I'm cool. And if all I want to talk about is going back to before Trump, then I'm cool. Which,
well, going before Trump, look, we had Clinton, who created one of the worst legislations for people inside. That was for years and years. So there's really nothing good about anything before Trump. I mean, that just, you know, we have fascism now. We had fascism then. It was just a little politer. But as far as, you know, reforms or taking care of people inside for health care, it hasn't improved. It hasn't improved.
No.
Well, what I hear you saying is that with all the time that people have been doing with all these prisoners, that they've been through at least, eight different presidents at this point or something like that, maybe a couple people who ran the same, you know, second term or whatnot, but that it's been so long. So saying that nothing's changed makes perfect sense in that way, because they've just been sitting around with all these different administrations who have done nothing largely to recognize them, and then that we have the few folks like you who were actually doing this work and getting the word out. So making sure that people are familiar with the Jericho Movement, which is thejerichomovement.com, the work of Critical Resistance with prison abolition, that's criticalresistance.org. We talked about Leonard Peltier. Who is Leonard Peltier? Info is the website there. Any other resources you want to kind of mention or throw out in our last minute here?
Yes, there's also part of one of the former Jericho members is part of this. It's called the RebuildCollective.org. And
okay.
It's got some very good information and newsletters that deal with political prisoners, RebuildCollective.org.
And I should say, and I got to add this quick, Rebuild actually, and at some point we're going to go into more detail with that with people, Rebuild as actually came out of a point when we were consolidating inside. those were, because we had so many people inside from the, actually from the, you know, from the independence movement, the Black Liberation Movement in general, and we recognized that we needed to get things a little bit more organized. There was a period called consolidation. During that period, we found, although that all New Africans didn't necessarily want independence. Good folks, there's a lot of good movements, but not all about independence. Rebuild was a slogan that was directed specifically to those people in those formations that was talking about consolidating around the issue of independence for the New African nation, which even, and that relates also when we say, like, even when people say, like, they're doing good stuff, it's like, for us, it's like, you know, they'd have to learn more about the Geneva Convention, because what people call good sometimes, even reforms, and that's cool in terms of improving the conditions of prisoners, but for our prisoners, you know, we want people released under the Geneva Convention, and it's tied to the whole independence of the New African people. Of course, I'm saying New African, but that's every other movement that was out there, whether it was against Puerto Rican decolonization, Native or Indigenous people and their movement. It wasn't just a thing where we just wanted to be good colonial subjects, because we had a problem with that at sometimes. People would come up with reform programs, but they was to make us better Americans.
Right,
and
right.
And we didn't want to be better Americans.
Right, right. That's why we need something else. So, well, thanks you all so much for your time. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Big thanks to our guests, Masai Ehosi and Paulette Dote, with the Jericho Movement, Critical Resistance, and more. And, of course, our engineer, Mr. Jason Rizzitello. Free them all.